You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello and Happy New Year. You are tuned to Cambridge 105 FM, community radio in your city, and welcome to a special New Year's Day edition of Bums on Seats. We have a studio fit to burst with regular reviewers all here to help in the countdown of our top 10 movies of the past 12 months. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show this morning are Emma Marchant.
Hello.
Sarah McIntosh.
Hello.
Simon West.
Hello.
Steph Smith.
Hello.
Mark Livesich.
Good morning.
And Jack Toy.
Hi, Toby.
The top 10 that follows isn't what we consider the best films of the year. With over 10 new releases every single week multiplied by the 52 weeks of the year, that's an impossible, rather fruitless discussion, especially when so many films still never really make it out of London. Instead, the next hour will be a countdown of our favourite films of the past year.
Hello, I'm here.
What do you want to say to me? I'm here to listen to whatever you have to say. I'm Samantha.
Hey!
Oh,
hey!
Hello. I've heard your music.
You know I could have killed you? Huh?
I've heard many nice things about you from Jim and Jean and from others.
You have not heard one nice thing about me from Jean. Ever.
Guy Donovan, from the Delice Valley.
Right.
You must be Mark.
Yes, hello.
So, LGSM. What does that stand for, then?
You know what? You don't deserve our money, you homophobic asshole.
How's that supposed to make me feel?
God damn you, I thought you knowed something.
I did as instructed. If there's something wrong, it's wrong with the instruction.
You know, like, the moment seizes us.
Yeah, I know, it's constant. The moments, it's just... It's like it's always right now, you know?
Every Bums on Seats reviewer, and we are legion, supplied their own 10 favourite films of the year, and those lists merely form the base metal of our top 10. Lists were also provided by the staff at the Arts Picture House, those behind the scenes at community cinemas at Saffron Screen and St Ives, the writers for Take One and Hacked Off, and those who attended December's Arts Pictures Picture House movie quiz. So, without further ado, let's start at number 10. And to keep things moving along numerically, this year we've enlisted the help of classic 1970s Sesame Street. 2004 was a strong year for films of a spiritual persuasion, from the blockbuster theology of Darren Aronofsky's Noah to the bleak ferocity of Stations of the Cross. But it is the first film on our list, Calvary, that makes the biggest impression. Written and directed by John Michael McDowell, Calvary stars Brendan Gleeson as Father James, the priest of a modern Irish community that no longer seems to have a need for its disgraced church. The film begins with a threat, with Father James learning of a parishioner abused by the church when he was a child, who has plans for him to be a saintly Catholic sacrifice. Sarah, we'll come to you. We had a long, you may not remember, but we had a long, long discussion after we reviewed this film back in April, I believe. The way we thought dealt with the film was how we thought about religion. And obviously that was really what struck you, as I seem to remember, was its take on this community's need and hatred of the Catholicism it had.
It depends on which character you're talking about as to their take on it. But, I mean, there's this overwhelming sense, not hatred, as kind of loss of this thing that used to mean so much and, you know, now it's not the strong, unfallible thing that held these communities together. And I think, you know, there's a lot to be said. The religion part is part and parcel of the whole sense of identity in almost a national way as well as spiritually.
Steph, to come to you next. Coming to the film myself as an atheist, I actually felt it showed a need for the church and the community at the same time as showing that the community felt it didn't need it. And I think it did that with Dylan Moran's character.
I'm not sure it showed need, but it showed failure. I mean, you've got Brendan Gleeson playing a priest in a community where he's constantly apologising for the church, and he's lost all his power. He's almost become a figure of fun, but then people start approaching him, start talking to him, and you realise that he actually does still have this function. He still works with people one-on-one, talking about their problems, but doesn't actually have status as a figurehead anymore in the community. So it's the background of the film is almost the decline of the Catholic Church. And then against this, there's the story of a death threat against him and how he deals with that death threat. And so the film constantly has that kind of harbinger of death sitting in the background. And it's how he puts his affairs in order, how he deals with his relationship with his daughter, with his relationship with the community over that period of time. And I think his daughter is fantastically portrayed.
Kelly Riley?
Yeah, Kelly Riley was
a wonderful actress.
Absolutely brilliant in this. And the relationship between them was beautiful. That conversation over the phone, which is back in London, I thought pretty much defined the film. And I was, if I wasn't in tears, I was very close to it at that point. I thought that it was a very, very passionate film. And I loved it for that.
Okay, well, Cavalry came out in loss in the late spring and is available at a knockdown price on both Blu-ray and DVD.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight!
The number 9 film in our countdown was the feel-good hit of the autumn and seems about as British as a British film can be, taking as it does a story of social unrest and making a song and dance about it. Directed by Matthew Warkos and written by Stephen Beresford, Pride tells the true story of the lesbian and gay activists who, in the early 1980s, saw a mirror of their own persecution in the treatment the striking coal miners were being subjected to by Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government. But when they try and deliver the money they've raised to help a struggling colliery, they find the community less than thrilled to take it. Jack, you introduced Pride at the Cambridge Film Festival, and this was one or two on your film list. It obviously meant a lot to you.
I just loved it. The word solidarity comes to mind with the film, and I think it's important in this kind of the era we find ourselves in that we do stick together, even if we seem like we're from different groups, that we all stick together against a common enemy. And I think this film exemplifies that, whilst not being too preachy, whilst also being adorable and at times lighthearted, at times very sincere, at times very funny.
Sarah, is it too not flippant, but is it too skates around too many of the hard issues? Does it try too hard to be a crowd pleaser? Because it's an unusual crowd pleaser.
I guess in some ways it can be a little bit simplistic. However, the topics, if you just say them on their own, sound like they should be for a niche audience, you know, particular audience, whether that be, placing it in queer cinema or placing it in, topic about social, social justice. But what the film is able to do is, yeah, okay, maybe it simplifies to an extent, but then it gets that wider audience and then it gets them to love it as well.
Mark, there's a lot of characters here. Does it manage to keep a balance without patronising any of them? Because it can only offer broad strokes.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was somewhere in between the two stools when the film came out, that I liked a lot of it in terms of the sort of feel-good factor, but I had certain issues with it. I think one of the issues is the characterisation. There are possibly too many characters, and George Mackay's character and a couple of other characters don't quite get the screen time maybe you'd like them to. You know, it feels like they get sort of very short story arcs. Actually, maybe that's, you know, with hindsight, maybe that's inappropriate for a film like this, which is trying to achieve something different. So, you know, I think maybe I was a bit hard on it in that sense. I think with you know, 3 months hindsight from the film, I think my problems with the film are actually largely not problems with the film, but problems with society, because what this feels like is a film that's pitching at a society that's still not quite accepting. And actually, since I'm an accepting person, I would like a society to be slightly further forward in accepting those with social issues, you know, those, you know, however we're made. And yet, for some reason, we're not quite there as a society. And I think it was a line at the end of the film where one of the old ladies in the film is saying, "Oh, the gays are coming." And that, to me at the time, felt like it was still not quite accepting. But I don't think that's the film's fault. And I think actually it's a good film to have in the sense that it is trying to progress us as a society with a feel-good film, which hopefully then takes people back to think about the issues, because ultimately not everyone is accepting. So actually, with 3 months hindsight, I think I'm a lot happier with the film in that context than I was at the time I saw it.
OK, all right, we'll move on. Pride was released on DVD and Blu-ray on December the 23rd.
One, two, three, four.
With only 3 feature films to his name, Steve McQueen has shown the ability to interest big audiences in uncompromising films of tough stories. The 8th film on our list is 12 Years a Slave, McQueen's revelatory and unremitting adaptation of the true story of Solomon Northup. Chiwetel Ejiofor plays Solomon, a privileged African-American musician enjoying the liberal freedom west of the Mason-Dixie line, but who is then hoodwinked and kidnapped in the southern state slavery. Unable to convince his new owners that he is a free man illegally obtained, as opposed to the perfectly legal slaves he now works alongside, Northup sinks deeper and deeper into a hellish world he thought he'd never know. Mark, Shame, McQueen's previous film to this, is one of your films of the last few years, isn't it?
It's still my film of the decade, yes.
How did you find, I mean, obviously, and did this play as strongly for you?
Well, at the time, it was my second favourite film of the decade. So what can I say? I'm a Steve McQueen fan, absolutely, resolutely. You know, I saw this at a cinema while I was away for work, so I had to spend half an hour sitting in the car, sobbing uncontrollably before I drove back to my hotel, where I needed a pint to be able to just think about going to bed. This film just completely destroyed me. I have never sat in a film in a cinema where so many people are just sobbing uncontrollably. And it's not the normal sense of actually crying. I just felt this complete outpouring of grief and probably some middle-class guilt being excised there as well for the sins of generations.
But why did this film? Because you're not the only one, and certainly not the... I can remember Jenny on Bums on Seats saying something similar, not about the crying, but having a certain effect on her that she wasn't aware that some of this went on. Why has this film done that when there's been... I'm not saying that... We no longer need films on slavery, but we've had a lot of films. Why is this more effective than films of the past? Is it the perspective?
There's probably one scene in this which exemplifies for me both McQueen's technique and also the emotional impact, and that's when Chiwetel Ejiofor's character ultimately ends up almost being hanged. And so we see him, he's been strung up, his toes are barely able to touch the ground, and he's sort of choking. And we get this succession for 4 or 5 minutes of just long static shots with the camera locked off. And what you see is predominantly black characters, the other slaves, with life continuing in the background because they know better than to try and do anything to rescue him. And that underlines the sense of total oppression, that no one would even step in to save a man who is at, you know, death's door. It also, for me, underpinned how good McQueen's technique is, that he's willing to play out those long shots. You know, that he's got the artistic sensibility because he's got a background. He's a former Turner Prize winner, I think. And, yeah, he will play that artistic sensibility. But he's managed to meld that with something which can be hugely powerful in terms of the filmmaking technique.
Do you think the fact that it balances this, the fact that, as I said, west of the Mason-Dixie line, where African-Americans could move in a liberal society, obviously it wasn't perfect, but they were free men, with the fact that he's not a slave, he's a black man amongst slaves, and that context makes all the difference to how you view the slavery that's in the film.
Yes, I mean, it's the first film I can remember. There may have been others that really give that separation, that contrast, with the scenes you see at the beginning of, you know, the normal life as best it can going on before he gets abducted. And, you know, you're just completely sold into it by the depth of the performances, by Chiwetel Ejiofor's performance, by Lupita Nyong'o's absolutely stunning performance as Patsy, the most prominent female slave in the film. And the fact that Michael Fassbender comes in and is so totally abhorrent. But, again, you absolutely buy into his character. Another film this year that touches on you know, sort of vague religious themes, because a lot of what the slavery is doing again is underpinned by a belief that there's a religious...
They have a religious right to own other human beings.
Absolutely, and they are sticking to that rigidly, so it's again, another way that those themes have been explored this year. You know, I just can't say enough positive things about this, and I'm starting to... Even thinking about the film, starting to get a bit emotional now.
Well, let's move on. Okay. Just a guess. No. 12 Years a Slave is obviously available to buy on DVD.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, and this is the Bums on Seats New Year's Day special, running through the top 10 films of 2014. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio are Emma Marchant, Sarah McIntosh, Simon West, Steph Smith, Lark Livesich, and Jack Toy.
One, two, three, four, five.
The number 7 film in our countdown is Dallas Buyers Club, the film which moved Canadian art house director Jean-Marc Vallée into the mainstream and rewarded Matthew McConaughey's recent return to dramatic acting with an Oscar. McConaughey plays Ron Woodruff, an alpha male rodeo rider whose life is turned upside down when he's diagnosed with HIV. Realising his prescribed treatment is only making him sicker and weaker, he becomes an unlikely entrepreneur in ferrying unsanctioned but effective HIV medicine across the border from Mexico. Sarah, this was one of your favourite films of the year, but you've liked this director's previous work.
I mean, yeah, this film was always going to have a bit of an easy pass with me to an extent, because ever since seeing Crazy, Jean-Marc Vallée is a director whose career I've followed with great interest. Like every Jean-Marc Vallée film, the cinematography is beautiful, and the story, it's full of heart without being, you know, crushed by sentimentality. And the two lead performances, both Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto, just phenomenal.
Emma, this was one of your films of the year as well, and I know it's not just simply the Matthew McConaughey effect.
No, you know, so close to it. No, it wasn't. I mean, it was an incredibly charismatic performance, as is Jared Leto as well, and a lot of the film is carried through, I think. I think I said this at the time. It's not, in many ways, it wasn't a huge stretch for Matthew McConaughey. I personally don't think, anyway. Yes, he lost a lot of weight, but he was kind of, it was that sort of Texas good old boy persona that he has, but what he found was a kind of depth of character of when this kind of Texas good old boy is thrown into this just completely confusing state of affairs, which came as a complete shock to this guy who, you know, the film starts off with some... I remember going to see it with my mother, and there are some fairly full-on scenes at the beginning with the groupies, with then some hookers back in his trailer. What it also does a really lovely job of, I think, is just that underbelly of society at the beginning. You know, the trailer life that they are living.
Because obviously I'm such a thing for this director, that some of the shots were just like, you know, Matthew McConaughey spitting and his dirty fingernails, and, you know,
they don't hold back from that at all.
So beautiful. in a kind of
beauty
seedy
in,
way.
Yeah, beauty and kind of sheer ugliness and seediness. And it is just it's. I think it garnered so many awards last year because it's that classic kind of American independent that they love, where it is the story of, you know, one man's fight against the odds and told in this kind of, so there's something you can really, that, you know, most people can hold on to something in this film and kind of get, you know, take something away from it. So yeah, it was a brilliant film.
Okay. All right, well, Dallas Buyers Club is available on DVD, while Jean-Marc Vallée's new film Wild with Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern opens in February. It's been a strong year for smart science fiction. Even the summer blockbusters seem to revel in ideas as much as they did in spectacle, but nothing comes close to the extraordinary images and ideas hosted by our number six film on the list, Jonathan Glazer's chilling masterpiece Under the Skin, based on the novel by Michelle Faber, though it uses it more as an influence than a sacred text. Under the Skin is more abstract than mainstream cinema has been in a long while. Scarlett Johansson, her Hollywood gloss fascinatingly framed amongst sink estates and nightclubs, plays an alien honey trap, a tempting lure that drives among present-day Glasgow in a white van, luring unwitting men to their surreal and horrifying doom. Simon, you were very, very taken with Under the Skin, but I think it was your top one of the year.
Film of the year, yeah.
It's a polarising film. Why did you fall on into the good camp so strongly?
It is one of those films that really does take the essence of cinema, and you need to be able to see, preferably in a big screen, to fully take in and understand. It's not a straightforward film. You don't necessarily understand everything that's going on, at least on the first viewing. But as such other classics such as 2001 and Donnie Darko have gone on to show, you do not have to understand a film to really enjoy it and for the film to be really good. You know, from starting off from strange visuals to the audio soundscape throughout this film gives it an alien feel to begin with, which is a nice sense of otherworldliness, which you rarely get to see. I mean, the whole film, it asks big questions, even quite subtly, about what's it like to be human, what is humanity, as I say, what is the soul underneath the skin.
It's as Simon said, Mark, it's a simple film. It's simpler than the book. It's really just taking the premises of this lure being cast out onto the streets and dragging men back, but it's almost primal. I felt it's such an extraordinary piece of work.
Mm. I mean, I have to say that when I originally watched it, I wasn't that impressed by it. I sort of took the film in. I liked a lot of the artistic decisions about it. Then I discovered, having left the cinema, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And that probably went on for 2 or 3 months. That every time I went to a cinema, I found myself then casting back and comparing to bits I'd seen in Under the Skin. You know, I think in some ways it's almost revolutionary filmmaking. When you compare what Jonathan Glazer has done prior to this, nothing stood out anywhere near to the extent that this is willing to make just such bold and brave decisions in almost every aspect. And even now, well, about 9 months after it screened, there are bits of it still lingering with me.
It's a film of, and of course it's the film with the beach scene, which is, mm-hmm. I don't think I ever want to watch again. it's and I know some people walked out of the cinema during that scene. It is easily the most horrific thing of the year, yeah. I think. Sarah, this is to finish on this. It's science fiction is very good at removing us enough to look back at the human condition. You know, it's a good way of examining where we are now. And this doesn't paint the most positive portrayal of men, or at least that was my takeaway from it.
Well, I really thought it was, I was quite fascinated because obviously there's lots of very classic, film theory about the camera's gaze and it being masculine. And I was struck by, as a female watching it, that I felt like, you know, Scarlett Johansson, you know, she's always considered, you know, such a beautiful, sensual woman that you know, and to be looked at and adored. And in this film, the camera didn't do that for me. And I was sort of very excited by that, very excited that it seemed to be not lingering over her as some kind of Well, I mean, as I say, sexual object. I mean, I guess the whole point is she is predatorial. She is a sexual object in a way, but these men are just as much as she is. But yeah, I don't know. As I said, at a risk of sounding a bit sexist about it, I was pleasantly surprised that a male director approached it in that way.
But I think that's an important part of the film because she's. We all identify with our bodies. They, you know, if you talk about me, you're talking about not just my mind. You're talking about, you know, my physicality. She is an alien in a human skin. It's not her body. Yeah. It's a vehicle. It's something that she uses to sort of get around in and to do what she has to do during the film. And I enjoyed the exploration of that. The fact that she doesn't identify with what she looks like. At one point, she says, "You do think I'm beautiful." And it is a genuine question. I hate coming out positive because this was one of the films. I'm the negative voice in the studio. This is a film that I love the cinematography. I love the visuals of it. I love the performances. Me and Toby argue about this a lot. I didn't like the lack of plot. I felt it needed a little bit more movement within the story to be able to establish the characters. I don't think you can establish the motivation of somebody without them actually doing more. And I really had a problem with that.
I totally disagree. The ambiguity is part of its charm for me. I don't think it had enough plot not to be nonsensical, but you know, I don't. It wasn't tied to it in some kind of, you know.
Well, if the whole plot is I need to put a plug in for the book. The theme of the book is an exploration of humanity, and I think the film makes a stab at that. But without knowing her motivation for abducting and killing men, how can you understand how she grows into humanity? And I think that missing that vital ingredient spoiled the film for me.
For me, that's what makes it so alien and what makes it...
Yes.
It brings in the humanity to an even greater level because you don't have that context, you don't have that understanding that is truly alien. So,
and that was a problem for me. I wanted to know what she was doing, why she was doing it.
Yeah.
And because for you to change your opinion, your decision on the way you behave, it's important to know why you're behaving in that way.
Mm.
Or for us to know, even if it is a weird alien reason. To me, without establishing that, I don't think the conversion worked.
Okay. All right, well, Under the Skin is available to watch on DVD and Blu-ray as usual, but pick your hour carefully.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The Coen brothers have a history of dabbling in fun adventures with hummable soundtracks, which is why, for some, the bleak tone of the number 5 film in our countdown, Inside Llewyn Davis, came as a surprise. Oscar Isaac plays the eponymous focus of the film, a singer-songwriter whose undoubted talent never quite seems enough to lift him out of the Greenwich Village poverty he's stuck in. Often criticised for treating their characters with cruelty, the Coens certainly have fun with running their folk singer through the ringer. But more than anything, Inside Llewyn Davis is that rarest of America stories, a film about failure. Mark, it did turn, I know we'll speak to Jack later briefly, but people were going in expecting a far more cheerier film than they got, and it's very funny, but it is a bleak film, especially the last five or ten minutes.
Yeah, it feels more of a companion piece to films like A Serious Man that they've done recently, some of their earlier work as well. I think maybe people were slightly skewed by the fact that it's the same soundtrack producers as Oh Brother Where Art There. It couldn't be more of a polar opposite to that film in terms of the overall tone. It is very much, though, another story about a horribly oppressed by life Coen everyman, this one who happens to be a folk singer. It is a melancholy film. It is a film of a particular mood that you need to tune yourself into, and I think then you'll get the most out of it.
Sarah, it's one of a few films this year, We Are the Best is another one that isn't in the top 10 but again got near, that really... for all its bleakness, really gets across the joy of music making. There are some scenes in this film where they're just filled with the knowledge that even the least talented people in this film that aren't up to Llewyn Davis's level are just want to do this.
It was the community of music making as well, and you know, it definitely, even as bleak as the film is, it sort of still made me sort of want to be a part of you know, wish I could go back in time and be in Greenwich Village in the 60s, you know, early 60s, late 50s. And there's, you know, yeah. I mean, but for me, I mean, yeah, the music is stunning. It's my favourite soundtrack of the year, definitely. But, I mean, also just... it's such a nuanced film for me. It's the way that it doesn't actually seem to go anywhere is so in keeping with the character, and just perfect. And I think if they had done it any other way, if you know, that it would have lost its impact.
It's said earlier, Emma, it's unusual in that he is talented. He's not a joke. He's a bit lost without his partner, who's his songwriting partner, his singer partner, who's committed suicide before this film started. But he's not good enough. He just doesn't have it. I think that's what makes it so remarkable to me, is that if it's a film about talent, doesn't always help.
No, it's a question about timings and the transientness, you know, and yeah, it can depend on what mood someone's in and that kind of thing. But what hasn't been mentioned, I would just like to say, is Oscar Isaac blows that performance out of the water. I know he's been in other stuff before, but I think I'm right in saying it's probably his first big film, big lead. And I couldn't imagine anybody. I just couldn't have imagined anybody else. I thought he was the heart of what is a very bleak soul, a very bleak, and he's not necessarily particularly likeable either. It's not necessarily that you're particularly sympathetic towards him, but yet he is the heart. I mean, he behaves appallingly at some of those dinner parties with some of his older friends in New York. He behaves shockingly, and yet you're still kind of rooting for him right for the end. And I just think it's a really, really great performance.
But I thought, what I think the film does as well is, like, you can, well, I don't know, I mean, this is the sense I was left with, that it's almost his own fault that he doesn't make it, that he's kind of resigned himself to this fact that he's not going to, and
he kind of, I think it's he's stuck in this Sisyphean circle.
Stuck.
He can't get out.
He's very stuck.
But he can never roll that rock all the way up the hill. It will always roll back down again. It just will not happen. It doesn't matter how good. And at the end, the appearance of Dylan at the end, that brilliant moment where he realizes, you know, from his face that, oh, that really is, I am good. He is good. He's better than anybody else in the film as a songwriter, but he isn't it. Then a genius comes at the last moment, and everything's put into perspective, and everything's going to change. It's going to move on. He's going to be left behind and have his one record, and that's it. Sorry, Jack.
Was that the same instance at the start of the film as at the end? Is it the same time in the club? Because I was really confused with the chronology when I watched it. Admittedly,
it's not. I don't think it's specifically the same time, but obviously, it's an echo of the, as if this is just going to keep happening.
Well,
it's part of
thing,
it's, again. It's a Sisyphean thing.
And I also the other thing I was thinking was, I felt so cold while I was watching the film, physically so cold. Okay. I remember seeing The Paperboy and physically feeling incredibly sweaty because it did this really good thing of, you know, it had this very visceral, that chill is so well done.
Has there been a film that I want to watch again because I really like the soundtrack, and I don't think there has been? So it must be a testament to the power of the music, the musicality of the film, that I want to give it a second watch.
I was going to come to that to end, because you've got, is it an R screen performance?
Yeah, I've got an R screen show at the end of Feb.
So you're programming it in February. You've learnt nothing.
With a warming whiskey, though, I believe.
With a warming whiskey.
Whiskey drops your blood temperature. Anyway, let's not get into science. Okay, or as you said, Inside Llewyn Davis is available to purchase on DVD and Blu-ray. And as Jack just said, there's a special screening, an R screen screening planned for February at the Arts Picture House, and there'll be more details on the Arts Picture House website.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, and this is the Bums on Seats special, running through the top 10 movies of 2014, and we're now on to number 4.
1, 2.
We've another smart science fiction at number 4, though this time the alien presence is welcomed into the home with open arms. Written and directed by Spike Jonze, the broken-hearted Her is number 4 in our 2014 countdown. Set in a future where the world looks like a sterile Asian city, Her stars the wonderful, versatile and constantly surprising Joaquin Phoenix as a morose writer made all the more miserable when his childhood sweetheart leaves him. He decides to amuse himself by purchasing a new home organizer software that boasts cutting-edge AI, the constantly curious and quick-witted Samantha, delicately voiced here by Scarlett Johansson. Steph, this was one of your films of the year, and it played, and actually I was surprised when I was building up the top 10, it made a lot of appearances, and it was a film I'd sort of forgotten about despite liking it. What stuck with you about it?
Well, this came out as my number 2 of the year. It was... I grew up with science fiction and a certain genre of science fiction. The thing I loved about it was the fact that a good science fiction story can create a world in exactly the shape it wants to examine an aspect of human nature, human behaviour, our culture, and can isolate it from the rest of the world to just look at it a little bit more closely. And what this does is this creates the ultimate alien presence. It's an AI, a computer, and then it tries to tell a very unlikely love story between a human and what is essentially an electronic presence. And so by doing that, it examines the idea of kind of xenophobia, of crossing cultures, of during the film she grows in intelligence, she becomes more and more complex, and it looks at the relationships between people of different intelligences, how they get along, what they do when one of them doesn't quite keep up with the jokes of the other. And so it just examined all kinds of problems that can hit relationships by extracting it in this very unlikely scenario. And I thought that was just a beautiful story that it told.
Mark, to come with you as the third voice on this, again, I can't remember if it was in your top... I don't think it was in your top 10.
Right, in my top 10.
It is. So, again, so you had a similar reaction to Steph.
I probably similar reactions to both of you to a certain extent, because I thought probably until maybe the last 10 minutes or so it was in contention for Film of the Year, and then at the ending I just felt was maybe a little rushed, a little cheap, didn't quite finish the story the way I was expecting. But sometimes that's the way relationships go, I guess. They don't finish how you expect in life or necessarily give you what you're looking for. So again, it'll be interesting to revisit the film and see if that on a second viewing gives something different. The thing which astonished me, of course, is that Samantha Morton was originally the voice of the AI and was then replaced later by Scarlett Johansson. So it's almost
I believe she actually recorded, didn't she?
She was on set for a lot of the performances, and which obviously Scarlett Johansson wasn't because she was brought in so late.
And yet the chemistry between Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson is just astonishing, given that they would have never interacted even sort of offset to that extent. It's two entirely separate performances composited together in a way that just feels completely and totally natural, and you absolutely buy into the fact that he would choose to enter into a relationship with this AI.
But that to me, again, it explores the human condition. And if you have a relationship where one partner is disabled and unable to have sex, you've then got that kind of that discontinuity between the two who want to keep each other happy, want to stay together, want to fulfil each other's needs, but are unable to. And I thought it created this really interesting conflict between the two characters, where she wants to be with him for everything that he needs.
But you're still talking about Samantha as if she's real in some form. She's just software. She's just programming.
I'm just software.
Is there something to be said, though, perhaps, for the fact that Scarlett Johansson does do such a remarkable voice performance and is such a recognisable voice? It's very hard not to be picturing Scarlett Johansson. And I personally had this problem, I would say, that really I just was picturing Scarlett Johansson the whole time. She's so very recognisable and she is gorgeous. You know, no one can deny that. So you are instantly thinking about an incredibly attractive version of a automated...
I found it really cringe, the whole film. And I, in my mind, I was watching it and thinking, it's just Joaquin Phoenix here talking to like a little box. There's no other character there. And I couldn't personify this little AI watch or ear widget or whatever it was as a real character. And so those phone sex scenes, I was just like squirming in my seat, like, this is embarrassing. And that maybe is to do with relating to characters. If you can't relate to a character on the screen, you're not going to get hooked. And I didn't believe I believed like Hal was a real malevolent character in 2001, but it was just like Scarlett Johansson's voice, and I was really like taken out of the world, and I was just watching a film set.
Okay, well, so Steph, one of your films of the year, Jack, less so. So,
absolutely.
What have we learned here,
everybody? Whether or not you believe in the characters, whether or not you engage, and I certainly the relationship between them seemed real and got me.
Anyway, so we will move on to the third film in our top ten. After dalliance with family film and Technicolor psychodrama, the number three film on our list, The Wolf of Wall Street, finds director Martin Scorsese back with the gangsters. Based on the self-aggrandizing autobiography by motivational speaker Jordan Beaufort, this is a film that depicts capitalism red in tooth and claw. Uninterested in providing a moral compass to direct its audience, Wolf of Wall Street plays as almost a wildlife documentary, capturing the bankers and stockbrokers in their natural habitat. Leonardo DiCaprio plays Beaufort as an attractive monster, the hyperactive symbol of a system and a country driven entirely by greed for the sake of greed. Emma, I know this was one of your favourite films of the year.
Yeah, I am a huge, unashamed fan of all the work I think Martin Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio have done together. The Departed, The Aviator and Gangs of New York. Yeah, all brilliant in their own ways. And I just thought this was an unashamed orgy of excess visuals. And it was just flat out funny. It had some of the funniest scenes I saw all year. But it just was a ride of excess and enjoyment. And I didn't... It's a very long running time. I wasn't bored at all. I went with it and I really, really enjoyed it.
Mark, again, people were sort of wondering what Scorsese was interested in here, but it's a film, like many Scorsese films, it's a film about outsiders, it's a film about class. This sits equally well with Age of Innocence as well as it does with Goodfellas. It's the same, he's still fascinated by the same things.
He is, and I think it's just then bringing those into something that's got a contemporary relevance. You know, there is nothing more relevant to us at the minute in that sense than you know, the issues we've gone through with the banking industry, which has affected the lives of pretty much everyone in some sense, you know, even if they didn't know it. You know, I think you mentioned the moral compass as well earlier, and the sort of indignation from some people that he doesn't then try and portray a second side to the story. I think there's something clearly wrong with you if you can't tell that this is morally vacuous behaviour. You know, the fact that it is stretched out to 3 hours just to drill this point home serves to me to then underline that with the climactic scenes of showing that, you know, the punishment wasn't there, that he sort of moved on with his life, and that's the kind of society that we're living in now. So I don't think that would have carried the weight at the end without these scenes of extended debauchery in the middle. The great thing about that is, of course, we get to watch Leonardo DiCaprio and Jonah Hill just behaving absolutely appallingly for an extended period of time, which is huge amounts of fun.
It's another film, again, like Under Skin and a few other films are discussing, where repetition is the main filmmaker's tool.
Yes, and in the wrong hands that can be a bit of a disaster, but I think when you're someone as assured as Martin Scorsese is, you know, there are a lot of interesting beats. Some of it does become a bit over the top. You know,
well, it's a fact that by sort of the start of the third act, you're beginning to realise that your narrator is unreliable anyway.
It's almost as if, you know, he's become an unreliable narrator because the sort of, you know, the drugs in his brain have almost filtered into the narrator actually relaying.
Well, he's
the story
a motivational
back.
Speaker now. This is yes. What he does. This is all he ever was good at. And the film makes a point of, especially with the law shop where they're playing tennis in this sort of institution, rather that's their version of a prison, and they can't even play tennis properly. They can't hit the ball from one side of the net to the other because they're not good at anything. It's just they can just talk. They're just talkers.
Oh, yeah, I suppose that my one note of caution about this is I was stood in a supermarket, or remain nameless, when those first came out on DVD, and somebody did wander up to me and sort of recommended the film to me because I was looking at the box, probably assuming I hadn't seen it. And I got very much the impression from talking to him that he saw it almost as a sort of, you know, poster film for that generation. So I think if you do happen to have misplaced your moral compass, yes, it could be dangerous, but hopefully there are enough people out there to actually have some common sense and realise exactly what this film is trying to say.
Okay, all right. Well, we better head onwards and upwards. We are at number two. The The number two film on our countdown should come as no surprise. Richard Linklater's Boyhood is ambitious and remarkable as narrative film can be, and a humanistic masterpiece of American cinema. Filmed sporadically over 11 years, Boyhood is the simple story of Mason Evans Jr., first seen as a six-year-old lying on a lawn and daydreaming. From that first moment until the last, Mason is played by Ella Coltrane. Over nearly 3 hours, the magic of cinema ages him in front of our eyes, from a trouble-free boy through his temperamental teenage years to the growth and promise of college. Emma, to come back to you very quickly, this was your film of the year. I guess it struck a chord.
Yeah, I guess so. I am a mother of three boys, so there is certainly, and it's seen not just with me. I think I put something on my Facebook feed about this, and just about every mother I know, every 40-something mother, just came back and said, yeah, Patricia Arquette just broke, it seemed to me, like a million 40-year-old women's hearts in one of the most beautiful scenes. And I think, you know, towards the end where Mason is going off to college and, you know, his mother sort of sits there and says, well, you know, is that it? I've done all of this. Of course, she as a character has made some terrible choices over the 12 years anyway. But it's just, as a piece of filmmaking, as an experiment, there were so many ifs and buts about this, I guess. You know, Ella Coltrane was, what, six years old, yeah, I guess, when they started this. There was no knowing how he was going to age. There's no knowing he's going to want to keep on doing it. And I think that his sister, who's also fantastically cast, is Richard Linklater's own daughter. She does a really good job. Ethan Hawke, obviously, and Richard Linklater work so incredibly well together. And it was a joy to see Patricia Arquette in such a fantastic role, because, I don't know, I feel like I've missed her on the big screen. I know she does a lot on the TV, but I haven't seen her. And it just was a joyous piece of filmmaking with heart and soul and beauty and truth and realism. It was my film of the year by quite some way.
Mark, I like Richard Linklater more than I think I admire him more than I enjoy his films, and I enjoy Boyhood a great deal, but it does to me suffer because Ella Coltrane doesn't grow up in the film, I'm not saying in real life, it doesn't grow up to be the most fascinating of characters, but really that's sort of the point of the film in the end. He starts as an observer watching the sky, he ends as a photographer, well, goes to college as a photographer. Does that allow him to become too much of a really to spend? I know, and actually I think it reflects a little bit badly on Richard Linklater's dialogue for the before films, and the fact that he can spout this sort of teenagery stuff that sounds like Linklater dialogue. He becomes a mouthpiece for Linklater. Do you think that's a weakness, and maybe it should have been a little bit, they should have had slightly a stronger character at the core?
I may be the wrong person to ask, because I had a lot of empathy with Ella Coltrane's character, being someone myself who went through most of adolescence being the person happy to just sit and observe in the background, and then gradually as I came into my teenage years, slightly more willing to sort of come to the fore. So, you know, in that sense, it was very much a route into the film for me in terms of you know, watching the characters in the background going on. I think this actually, as opposed to Wolf of Wall Street, is one where a certain amount of repetition does struggle slightly, because it's going through some of the same sequences with Patricia Arquette repeatedly ending up with sort of alcoholic partners. I didn't think that was quite as effective in terms of repetition, although I could see the same
point. Is it trying to build some sort of fake drama? Because it doesn't quite embrace its abstract, it's this linear approach. It still has to throw these moments of drama in. And it's always her. To come back to Emma saying he writes female characters, she's always the one that suffers at the hands of drama.
We had this argument about before. Did we? Midnight as well, yes, where you said that Julie Delpy was a screaming shrew, and I said no, she wasn't. I felt that very
the character was, rather than her.
Sorry, Julie Delpy's character. I disagree. I politely disagree as well. I think it probably is quite documented that people will make the same mistakes over and over again in their life, and I think it's quite, you know, yes, okay, Ethan Hawke manages to kind of, you know, it's interesting, he does kind of mature, gets rid of the sports car, gets a station wagon, you know, finds happiness and a kind of a settled nature in his second family maybe, but I think it's just interesting that, yeah, the Patricia Arquette character is just she does make the same mistakes, but I think we do that. And to say about the Ella Coltrane character not being particularly interesting, he's still only 18 when the film ends, so I get the feeling he's on the cusp, he's still really a child, a mild man child. I don't know, he's not terribly old by the end of it, do you know what I mean? He's still being formed.
And there's a real like magical sense to the cinematography in this film, in that you watch a scene at the start and Ella and his sister Laureline, they're kids. Mason and Samantha, and then 10-15 minutes later you realise, hang on, we've jumped forward like 3 years, but I'm not aware where the cut has gone. And I found myself thinking that loads throughout the film. Like, wait a minute, he's 17 years old. He was just like a kid when we started here. And it's got the most heartbreaking haircut scene in 2014.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. One of the scenes of the year, yes. Yeah. That is quite brilliant. Yes, I think it's a superb piece of cinema, and I think it's one of Linklater. It's not one of the American films of the last 10 years.
I think it's undoubtedly much greater than some of its parts.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. All right, now we better head on to number one. And at number one in a victory for planimetric composition in Russian doll narratives is The Grand Budapest Hotel. The eighth feature film from director Wes Anderson, The Grand Budapest Hotel manages to be both the most baroque and melancholic of his films, with a carefully layered story that conjures up a perfect pre-war Europe, only to let it be destroyed by both time and jack-booted bullies. Leading an all-star cast, Ralph Fiennes plays the dapper and flirtatious Gustav H., head concierge to the Grand Budapest, and a man whose home comforts are put in jeopardy when he's framed for murder. Mark, this was leagues ahead of everything else. What's the appeal of Grand Budapest?
I think in terms of Wes Anderson's particular style, this is about as a refinement of that as you could possibly wish to get. You look at the production design, the fact that you get some of these little sort of stop motion cutaways, the scene down the ski slope, which is a huge amount of different techniques being put together to actually film that with live actors and models. You know, the fact that it's almost sort of layered like a Russian doll. There are, I think, four different time periods it steps through. Alexandre Desplat's score and some of the music he mixes in was one of my scores of the year. I was still sort of humming that for days after I left the cinema. The performance is great. Ralph Fiennes is again, I've used the word revelation once today already, I'll use it again. I think sometimes comedic performances can be undervalued in the grand scheme of things when it comes around to awards nomination, and I think he absolutely just knocked this out of the park. I thought he was absolutely brilliant.
Steph, the melancholy that Mark mentioned there, that's my lasting impression of the Budapest Hotel. Out of all the Wes Anderson's films, this is the one where the period is vanishing, where he's actually making a case. He's answering his critics by saying, making a case for these multi-tiered wedding cake films by saying, we have to do this because these things vanish, these things even. You know. And I found that fascinating. Did you find the film's sadness sort of overwhelmed the baroque nature of the narrative?
No, not at all. I know Wes Anderson for having this thread of melancholy throughout, I think, all of the films that I've seen. It just sits there in the background as one of the threads of the film, and then he weaves other things around it. So this one, what I took away was the comedy. I had no idea that Ralph Fiennes had such great comic timing and such great delivery. He was absolutely brilliant. The comedy was carried on through the other characters as well, though. And there were a lot of cameos, and if anything, this film's received criticism for undervaluing some of the good actors that they've got in there, that they're only in there for 10 seconds. But that's the nature of a cameo, and I thought they worked brilliantly well, just seeing a recognisable face for a few seconds. Normally I don't like that, but in this film it somehow worked. It just clicked. You had an established character, and I thought that was to its advantage. The visuals were spectacular. It was a great film. I love it.
Sarah, you've not been convinced by previous Wes Anderson films. This is the first one I think you've really, really taken to.
Well, no, I would say that actually was the one prior to this.
Moonrise Kingdom.
Moonrise
oh, yes,
Kingdom.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, I think Moonrise Kingdom for me was the first time. That was revelatory to me with regards to Wes Anderson, because up until that point I haven't seen every single Wes Anderson film, but I'd seen a few, and I'd sort of formed this impression of his films of being, you know, very formalized structure, you know, very very beautiful, very stylistic, but with not much real heart behind it. And I think Moonrise Kingdom, where you sort of started, well, for me, you started to see sort of an inkling of a bit more of an emotional connection to his films. And then, you know, that was then, expanded further when it came to Grand Budapest.
Jack, oh, sorry, go on. No.
I was just going to say briefly, I think, yeah, we talked at the time when Mood Indigo came about sort of joy in films, and you know, I now look back on the year, and this has brought me more joy than any film in the year. And I think where it won out over Mood Indigo is that it was better structured in terms of that composition between the joy and the melancholy, where Mood Indigo had that all weighted towards the back end. You know, this was a better construction in terms of the way it wove its moods in.
I agree with you and Mark in that sense of the film that has brought the most joy, and that's why it was my number one film of the year on my list as well. Fancy a director being able to make you laugh from changing from make you laugh through depth of field in a scene. Do you remember the scene when it's like, she was murdered and you think I did it, and then just by him running backwards towards the stairs, which is something he rarely does in his films, it's, as you say, it's normally like quite flat left to right. By introducing this depth of field, it was so funny, and you can't think of many directors that make you feel like that.
So everybody seems to feel it was a deserved winner. It was a bit like the Eurovision Song Contest when an Eastern European country takes an early lead, and because of block voting, it can never be assailed. It was a bit like that, building up these 40 or so lists. It was so early in the lead that there was no chance of even Boyhood catching up with it.
Robbed.
I think so much film gets, films that get to the top of lists and things tend to be quite earnest films. They have to be very worthy. Whereas, you know, this film is so, it has substance as well as being so joyful. And that, I think, is why it deserves to be at the top.
All right. Well, The Grand Budapest Hotel is readily available on both DVD and Blu-ray. It will be screening in the Village of Ickleton on the 17th of February as part of Saffron Screen's pop-up cinema movement in 2015. Wes Anderson, meanwhile, seems to be heading back into the world of animation. That is all we have time for. A longer version of this programme will shortly be available as a Cambridge 105 podcast. Keep checking the 105 website, www.cambridge105.fm, as well as our Twitter and Facebook link for details. We will be back in only 2 days, on the 3rd of January, with a full review show catching up with the last few releases of 2004 and the first few of 2015, including Exodus, Ridley Scott's epic retelling of Moses and the Flight from Egypt, the marriage of Stephen Hawking to Jane Wilde as the subject of the drama The Theory of Everything, interestingly directed by James Marsh, who directed The King, which is very good. Tim Burton's Big Eyes is his best-reviewed film in decades, whilst Unbroken is the remarkable true story directed by Angelina Jolie. We'll wrap up with some Lord Kitchener Calypso, with the original 1950s version of London is the Place for Me, which you can hear played in the background of various scenes in the wonderful Paddington, which is currently on general release. Please stay tuned for best of the Sunday daytime interviews, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye and Happy New Year.
London is the place for me. London, this lovely city. You can go to France or America, India, Asia or Australia, but you must come back to London City.